Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we'll talk about the many faces of Alzheimer's, including how the disease affects the entire body.
As the disease progresses into the late stages, other organs start to have difficulty in functioning correctly.
Plus, the diagnosis and treatment of migraines and other headaches.
You can find migraine as young as maybe 7 or 10 years old, but the peak is from 22 to 55 years old.
And a medical school's effort to increase interest in a primary care career in rural communities.
More of a cultural sensitivity. You develop a relationship with not only the family doctors, but the people you're living with in this small town. You get to meet them, you get to know their lives.
We'll have advice on treating sunburns and a poignant piece from our healing muse. And that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, that nagging headache, what could it be and how best to treat it? And with the numbers of primary care doctors shrinking, we'll learn how some of the next crop of doctors are being inspired to return to practice in the country. But first, 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women, and not just because women are living longer. What more do we need to know about this challenging disease? An estimated 5.5 million Americans of all ages have Alzheimer's disease, with 5 million of them age 65 and older. And the number of Americans with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias will grow each year as the size and proportion of the United States population age 65 and older continues to increase. By 2025, that number is estimated to reach 7 million. That's a 40% increase. We'll hear with more on this challenging disease and what can be done about it is Catherine James. She's the CEO of the Alzheimer's Association of Central New York. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming in, Catherine.
Thank you, Linda, for having me.
So let's begin with a quick review for our listeners. Give me a definition. What is Alzheimer's disease exactly?
Well, Alzheimer's is a type of dementia that causes problems with memory and thinking. And in other types of behaviors. The symptoms usually develop slowly and get worse over time and become severe enough to interfere with day-to-day living tasks. So as the disease progresses, an individual may have difficulty initiating their day-to-day personal care tasks that now they need someone within the family or a professional caregiver to help initiate that. Or as the disease progresses, we know that more direct physical care is needed. So this is a disease that that affects the brain, but because the brain is so closely tied to helping to direct all of the organs, finally, as the disease progresses into the late stages, other organs start to have difficulty in functioning correctly. So the individual may have difficulty swallowing, being able to walk, and finally being no longer being able to swallow and breathe.
But it's not a normal part of aging.
That is correct. The changes that we're talking about with memory, because we get lots of calls, Linda, at our office of people that
may
be concerned about changes that are happening within their memory. And what we how we describe what the difference is between normal aging and Alzheimer's disease, these are significant changes that are affecting your day-to-day life. So a slip up of somebody's name or missing an appointment, those are things that can happen for a wide variety of reasons. We're talking about changes that are happening that may affect the person's personality and behavior and their ability to recall short-term and long-term events.
But on average, once a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, what's the average general length of time that they
We
are
know
living?
That it can be anywhere between 5 to 7 years, but it can be as long as 10 to 20 years. And a lot of research now is taking a look at when are those changes in the brain happening? And we believe that those changes are taking place long before we're starting to see those outward symptoms. So a lot of the research now is focused on really backing up the clock even further to when a diagnosis and those symptoms may be looking at, that it could be decades as to some of those very slight changes that are taking place in the brain before we even see those outward symptoms.
Yeah, it would be great if we knew better, because perhaps we would develop some kinds of ways of evaluating, whether it be some kind of markers in the blood or what have you. And we'll get to that in a minute. But as far as the causes, you've alluded to the fact that changes are taking place in the brain. I know that there's no clear-cut, you know, theory at this point, or there are theories, but there's no clear-cut definitive knowledge of exactly what's happening.
Correct.
What's being thought right now?
Well, some of the best science at this point is pointing us to some changes that are taking place, again, early on in the cells of the brain. Many people probably hear the phrase plaques and tangles. So plaques are the microscopic clumps of protein that are occurring, the beta amyloid that is occurring on the outside of the cells. And there seems to be some abnormalities that occur with some of this naturally occurring protein that starts to twist. And so there are problems with it then becoming very abnormal and becoming clumping and so forth on the outside of the cells. And then there's tangles, microscopic tangles that are occurring called tau protein that are occurring on the inside of the cells.
And the idea is that it basically prevents those cells from functioning in their normal way, communicating from one cell to another, so that whatever it is that we don't even understand completely what makes up thought. But the fact is that thought or initiation of action by the brain is getting limited in some way. It's being interfered with or impeded in some way.
That is correct. And the brain has some plasticity to it, so it will find other routes, so to speak, to be able to have those neurons for a period of time. But we do know with the changes and the loss of connections among brain cells that it seems to start deep inside of the middle part of the brain called the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. And that is why individuals, one of the early symptoms we may typically see is problems with short-term memory. That individual that is asking those same questions over and over again, which can frustrate family members and caregivers. It is the hippocampus that helps to code and embed that that event and that memory so that you can recall
memory.
That back out again.
So how, and this is a question I know that, as you said, you might get calls all the time, but how is Alzheimer's different from other dementias? I mean, how do we determine it's Alzheimer's versus just some kind of dementia, or maybe just the process of aging?
Right. Well, and dementia is a very general term. So dementia really refers and describes a set of diseases and conditions that can damage the brain and the brain cells. So there are things such as that can cause dementia, such as nutritional issues, depression, clinical depression left untreated, Parkinson's disease as it advances, vascular causes, so strokes that cause those changes within the brain. Some of those things can be identified and reversed. So there are things such as nutritional and hormonal changes and thyroid issues and so forth that we may need to identify and determine, is that what's causing the changes to occur, and how might we be able to correct that? So, typically, Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of
Yeah, I
dementia.
Read somewhere 60-80% of the cases
that
are Alzheimer's.
Correct.
But there are things, even things that are kind of a little skewed, obscure, like Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome, Korsakoff syndrome, Lewy body, mixed dementia, frontotemporal. So there are other types of dementia out there. But as you said, Alzheimer's seems to be the one that is most prevalent or most common.
That is correct. And a patient can have Alzheimer's disease and one of the other dementias as well, too. So it can be a mixed dementia that we can see as well.
So besides the memory loss itself, just go over some of the other changes that we see, whether they be personality or behavioral changes. What do you see?
Sure. Besides the short-term memory loss, problems with judgment and reasoning. So we rely on our brain to be able to process, to help us to put things in a logical sequence. So an individual may have difficulty with planning out their day and executing it.
So even executive function kinds of things.
Exactly, exactly. Being able to pay the bills, being able to think through the process of what it takes to get yourself to where you need to go in the morning, being able to utilize aspects of your brain for spatial relationships. So an individual may have more problems with walking, mobility. Driving a car is oftentimes some of the early warning signs of unexplained and more frequent, maybe fender benders.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Alzheimer's Association of Central New York CEO Catherine James. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease and what can be done about it. Getting back to this idea of behavioral changes, how about personality changes? I've been told and I've heard that sometimes people really seem very, very different. I mean, where they may have been affable and friendly and outgoing, they can become very reclusive or very non-communicative.
And it can even be the flip side of that. So you may have someone that had a very amenable personality, and now all of a sudden they are much more irritated and agitated, and it's hard to pinpoint what might be causing that. There's areas of our brain that help us with controlling and modifying and knowing what might be socially appropriate.
So it's inhibition versus disinhibition.
Inhibition, sometimes an individual may say things or do things that may look very inappropriate given the social situation.
So just very briefly, what goes into the diagnosis?
The diagnosis at this point, because we are still trying to understand biomarkers and what might be some changes that are very early on happening within the brain or the blood, we know that we need to be looking at things like blood, work and just make sure that we're identifying and eliminating what might be some other changes that are happening that we can rule out infections, cancer, other things that may be going on. So oftentimes it involves a very thorough medical workup, the family history, patient history, because we do know that there is a family history link. It's not a definitive. There are some rare cases of Alzheimer's disease where there is a genetic marker for that disease. And if the family has that genetic marker, there is more of a likelihood of passing that down. So we're looking at that family history, as well as information from the primary care caregiver, and then looking at brain scan and then some cognitive testing, which based upon the questions and so forth that are asked and the responses can really pinpoint where some of that damage is occurring based upon where the more difficult responses lie.
So right now, from your perspective, and I know this is a constantly moving target, what treatments seem to be helping? I know there's not a cure for this disease.
That is correct. I mean, you know, Linda, this is the only disease in the top 10 that has no cure. Excuse me, and has no treatment that can slow the progression down to a point where we may be able to stop the progression. Treatment that's available right now helps with the symptoms. So many of your listeners are probably familiar with some of the ads that they've seen around Exelon and Aricept and so forth. That helps with what brain cells are still able to function and keep those connections as strong as possible. But the process of Alzheimer's disease still continues and still damages those, as well as treatments around behavioral changes that may be occurring. So the individual
lifestyle help.
Lifestyle help as well, too, absolutely.
So let's get to what tips you would have in your position and with the Central New York Alzheimer's Association in terms of what you can do. You have a program called Healthy Habits. What do you basically recommend for people who have a loved one with Alzheimer's?
Yes, and we have lots of recommendations for both the patient and the caregiver. So from a patient standpoint, we want to make sure that there's an accurate and fully disclosed diagnosis as well, too. Sadly, we hear from too many patients that haven't been disclosed of that diagnosis, and we know that they want to be part of that healthcare planning.
So you want them to be told.
If it is possible, because we do know that as the disease progresses, the patient may not be having that full knowledge and understanding. But in the early stages, it is important for that patient to be knowledgeable about that. Knowledge is everything. So we want to make sure that the patient and family are getting knowledge about the disease, about the next steps. We have a whole series of education programs around living with Alzheimer's for both the patient and the caregiver. support groups every step of the way. And
that's for both the patient and the caregivers?
That's correct. We do have an early stage support group for individuals living with the disease as well, too. And for some individuals, that's the first time they've had an opportunity to meet other individuals living with that diagnosis.
Do you think music can help in the very little time we have left? Music therapy?
Music therapy, pet therapy, art therapy. There is a lot of evidence to show that those are things that really assist with the patient. But we do know that there are some lifestyle supports and so forth that may not necessarily lead to prevention, but can help us lead a heart healthy and a brain healthy
You're talking
lifestyle.
About in advance, before a diagnosis.
Yes, and even during the diagnosis, we know that things such as cognitive activity, keeping the brain active, physical activity. There's a lot of research that's been going on around exercise, and it doesn't have to be high aerobic activity. Start with something you enjoy and do 10 to 15 minutes a day of it. Diet and exercise and nutrition, and finally social engagement of just being connected to other individuals within your community and within your family and your circle of friends.
Well,
very, very important.
Thank you so much for all this really helpful information. And I know the Alzheimer's Association of Central New York offers a tremendous amount of support for our community. Thank you again. My guest has been Catherine James, CEO of the Alzheimer's Association of Central New York. Next up, that nagging headache. Is something more serious lurking? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen joining you. Headaches can affect the quality of life. Some people have occasional headaches that resolve quickly, while others are quite debilitated. And while these headaches are not life-threatening, they may be associated with symptoms that can mimic strokes and can be quite frightening. Here with more on all of this is Dr. Osama Abdelrezzak, Assistant Professor of Ear, Nose, and Throat at Suez Canal University in Egypt. He's currently doing basic science research in the Department of Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Abdelrezzak.
Thank you
for coming in. So headaches, they can be terribly debilitating, but diagnosing and classifying them can be very challenging. Tell me about that.
Yeah, headaches, you know, we have about 300 diagnostic entity in headaches, and it's no man's land. You know, it's like when we studied headaches in medical school, it's like parts, apart in neurology, apart in internal medicine, apart in otolaryngology. So the approach to headaches is not like we don't have a course about headache or something like that, which makes it challenging to most doctors. You know, here and now, the misdiagnosis of migraine is so large. It's around 80 to 88% of migraine headaches misdiagnosed as sinus headaches. And also for the cluster headaches, the misdiagnosis is very high. It usually used to take around 9 years to reach the final diagnosis.
Wow.
9 years and 7 doctors.
Oh, my goodness.
7 different doctors.
Wow.
But now
that's
it's
staggering.
Improved.
Well, let's get to actually defining what we mean by some of these things and help us understand what are the processes that you go through to actually come up with diagnoses. And clearly, you want the right diagnosis so you get the right treatment.
Yes.
Right? So let's start with this idea of primary headache. I understand that most of the common headaches are now classified as primary.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Primary means that the headache is the disease itself, nothing else. It's headache. So it's the symptom and it's the disease. Versus secondary headaches, which is secondary to some other disease, like if there's head trauma causing headache, this is a secondary headache. Cancer causing headache, this is a secondary headache. But the headache is the primary disease.
So what are the three? I know there are three types of headaches they talk about as being primary. Help us understand what the three are.
These three are the most important. It's actually more than three, but these three are the most important headaches. Most common is tension headache. We call it daily headache or the common headaches that patients have. Usually it's caused by, you know, stress and mental tension and things like that. And the maybe up to 90% of people at one time have this type of headache, like one time in their life. So it's very common. And tension headache usually is mild to moderate in severity. The pain severity is not that severe. And it usually lasts from 30 minutes up to 7 days.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's might take
it can
a
be
long
quite
time.
Annoying,
yeah,
to
sure.
say the least. And it's usually, as you said, sometimes it's brought on by stress. They don't really understand exactly what causes it.
Usually mental stress causing this type of headache. And it's usually due to muscle tension, you know, head muscles contracting, causing tension-like headache. And usually it's a benign headache with no problem and can be easily diagnosed from the history and
so
examination.
So that's the question. So how do you diagnose this? How do you know this is a tension headache and not something else?
Yeah, the characteristics of headache, you know, it takes its frequency and the timing, you know, like it's a long time. It responds to over-the-counter medication, usually like... you know, the painkillers, the common painkillers people take for... you know,
like
for
Tylenol
headaches.
Or Advil.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're almost diagnosing it by virtue of its treatment, to its response to treatment.
Not exactly, but from the history more.
History and physical.
Yeah.
And actually the neurological exam should be
usually
normal.
Usually normal, yes. Yeah. There's no problem with that. And there is usually no family history of this headaches, like it's not hereditary or...
So basically, you treat it with things like over-the-counter medications like ibuprofen or acetaminophen, Tylenol, or naproxen, that kind of thing. But do you find also things like stress management or massage or yoga?
Sure.
Those things
also
help.
The medical treatment is for the acute attack, you know, but otherwise we need to de-stress. This is the most important, like yoga, as you said, and relaxation therapy and biofeedbacks and all these things.
So the second most common type of primary headache is the migraine, and you alluded to that before. You said up to 80% are misdiagnosed.
Yes.
So tell us, what exactly is a migraine headache? And before we go on, children as well as adults can get them. Is that correct?
Sure, yes. It's actually you can find migraine as young as maybe 7 or 10 years old, but the peak is from 22 to 55 years old.
And I read somewhere that before puberty, boys and girls get it equally, but after puberty, it's almost exclusively, or they're more, not exclusively, more men, more women than
more
men.
More women, yeah. It's around 18% of women have migraine headaches, and 5% of men have migraine headaches.
What exactly is happening in a migraine?
The actual mechanism is, you know, it's very hard. We used to say like it's a constriction of the vessels of the brain and then dilatation, and the constriction causes the aura and dilatation causes the headaches. But now this proved to be wrong. So, yeah, so the new mechanism is getting harder and harder, you know, the pathophysiology of headaches.
So we don't really understand it.
We understand few things. We understand it's inherited. It's a brain disorder or neurological disorder that's inherited. They said now it's around 20 genes responsible for this abnormality and the brain. And this makes the brain susceptible to what we called a spreading depression of the brain cortex. So this causes the migraine headaches, and it activates, you know, there's a nerve in the face, that's a sensory nerve called the trigeminal nerve.
Trigeminal, yeah.
Yeah, so it activates this trigeminal system and causes headaches in these susceptible patients.
So we know that, help us remember what some of the symptoms are. People sometimes have eye pain, they have sensitivity to light and sound. What are some of the other things?
Yeah, so the diagnostic criteria for migraine is... we have some criteria. Usually it's, but not necessarily, it's unilateral, so half of the head.
One side.
One side. It's, but in maybe more than 30% issue, it comes on both sides. But it's important if it's one side, and it's throbbing. It's not like pulsating. The headache is pulsating, and this is very important. And usually it prevents the patient from regular activities, like he can't climb stairs, he can't, you know, do activities.
It's severity, really debilitating.
Yeah, severity of pain is from moderate to severe, not like tension headache, mild to moderate. This is moderate to severe headache. So, and in women, usually more than 70% needs to go in a dark room and have bed rest. They can't continue to work. And around 50% of men have the same problem. So,
if you're just joining us, you're listening to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen along with Dr. Osama Abdelrazik, and we're talking about primary headaches and how to treat them. Getting back to migraine, how do you know you're not having a stroke? Because sometimes people have migraine headaches with paresthesia, meaning a numbness in their hands or even a weakness. How do you know the difference?
This numbness and weaknesses, it's a part of aura. The aura is usually visual. So we have like missing parts of the visual fields, or we have like flashes of light. And the difference between aura and what we call transient ischemic attacks is the duration. The aura usually takes from 5 minutes, not more than 60 minutes.
Not more than 60?
Yeah, not more than 60 minutes. So this is the aura. Neurological disease usually takes more than this. And aura is reversible, but others, transient ischemic attacks are also reversible, but if it's a stroke, it's irreversible. So, and also the history, you know, to diagnose migraine, we need 5 attacks with these, you know, characteristics to diagnose migraine, not from one attack. So it's very important when it's a new headache, it's a red flag. So
If it's a new headache, it's a red flag if you have some of those symptoms, you're saying.
Yeah, change in the regular headache. Like if I have this migraine symptoms for 10 years and they come at the same way and they increase the same way and disappear the same way, but now I have different, the symptoms are different. So this is a red flag. Maybe it's something else.
Do we know why some things are migraine triggers? Do they have any idea? Excuse me. Things like what we know that there are hormonal changes can do it, stress can do it, loud noises, and certain foods. But do we understand why things like coffee or red wine or any of that actually triggers it? Do we know why?
For red wine, there's like aged cheese, there's tyramine.
Which causes this
headaches. But, you know, otherwise, like mental stress is the highest trigger. It's 80% of the patients.
Is it really?
Have physical or mental stress can trigger the headaches. And hormonal change in women, especially with menses. So it's like 70% of the triggers.
So what's the most most effective treatment today? I mean,
migraine?
Yeah.
You know, we have 2 types of treatment. We have what we call abortive treatment and the prophylactic treatment. Abortive treatment to abort the attack. When we have migraine, we need to abort the attack. And usually if it's mild to, or if it's not very severe, because usually it's not mild, so if it's not very severe, we can use over-the-counter medications like Tylenol, aspirin, things like that. But if it's severe enough, we should start with migraine-specific medications like the triptans or ergots or things like that.
So the triptans are like sumatriptan, Imitrex, those kinds of things, or Maxalt, Ralpax. I'm just using names of the actual commercial names. Mm-hmm. But those are effective, and you say the ones that are prophylactic are what, lifestyle changes, but there are also medications that are prophylactic.
Yeah. So some patients need prophylaxis because if you give this medications for a long time, the patient might develop rebound headache, which I'll talk about later. So we need to give a treatment to prevent the use of these analgesics for a long time. So usually we give antidepressants, we give blood pressure lowering medications like we call it beta blockers. So
beta blockers and things that,
and also
calcium channel blockers.
Yes, and also anti-seizure drugs also helpful in this.
So those prevent them from even occurring.
Yeah, it usually our aim is to reduce the frequency of attacks by 50%. And the severity of attacks. So usually if we can do that, this is a good prophylaxis.
Is Botox being effective these days in helping with migraine headaches as well?
The evidence for this is not so good for Botox.
Not clear.
And it needs a very large doses. And
okay. And things like yoga and all kinds of stress management
would really
be helpful as well.
And also some vitamins like vitamin B2 have very strong evidence in prophylaxis. Vitamin B2. So
I myself am taking vitamin B2 and have found a change. So I will tell you that is one case. It seems to be helping. Let's get to cluster headaches. We only have a little bit of time. What are they? Who gets them? And how are they treated?
Cluster headache is not as common as migraine or tension headaches, but it's actually the severest form of headaches. They call it suicide headaches.
Wow.
Well, and I heard it from patients, many patients. They told me that they want to kill themselves because they can't take it. You know, it's so severe. So if we said that tension headache is mild to moderate, migraine is moderate to severe, this is severe to very severe. And it usually comes in attacks, in clusters. So usually like 2 months in the year, and then 10 months, okay, free from headaches, and then it comes again. In these 2 months, the headaches comes daily, maybe every other day, and other patients have up to 8 attacks per day.
And how is that treated?
This is treated also, we have like the abortive treatment and the prophylactic treatment. The abortive treatment, first thing we have the 100% oxygen, breathing 100% oxygen at the flow.
So putting on an oxygen mask.
Yeah, oxygen mask at a flow rate from 7 to 15 liters per minute. And this is usually 80% effective. And the other thing is we give also the triptans.
So the same thing treatment is for migraine,
yeah,
as well.
And for the prophylaxis, we give a drug called verapamil, which is a calcium calcium channel blockers. But for verapamil to work, it takes usually 2 weeks. So we need a bridge treatment between the abortive and the maintenance treatment. We usually use either a nerve block. We block a nerve behind the ear. It can reduce the pain. Or we can give steroids.
So we only have a little bit of time left. Obviously, diagnosis is crucial so that the treatment can be crucial. And you just said, so the basic red flags to know you're not having something more serious are if it's a change in something that's basically a new...
Yeah, if there's a change and if there is a new headache after the age of 50, new appearance of headache after the age, or if there's other symptoms like headache with fever, headache with neck rigidity, it might be meningitis or something like that. So if a headache in a cancer-prone patient, it's also very important, a red flag.
Very helpful information. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing it. We covered a lot of territory. Thanks for staying with me. My guest has been Dr. Osama Abdelrezek, assistant professor of ear, nose, and throat at Suez Canal University in Egypt, and he's currently doing basic science research in the Department of Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. For some expert advice from the experts at Upstate, dermatologist Ramsey Farr is here to explain what to do for a sunburn.
First of all, it's best to avoid a sunburn, but living in the real world, this is not always possible. So if you get a sunburn, you have to gauge how severe it is. If it's a blistering sunburn, actually, I would go and see your doctor just to make sure that it's examined and no possibility of scarring arises. Apart from that, the best thing to do is take an aspirin immediately. The aspirin has a lot of anti-inflammatory effects, and we find that that helps quite a bit in the acute response. After that, it's good to put sort of cool compresses on the sunburn area and even an over-the-counter 1% hydrocortisone. 1% hydrocortisone is enough to help decrease the inflammation but not affect wound healing. So you want to be careful not to put very strong steroids on it. And the other possibility, and this may sound funny, is if you put ketchup on your sunburn. Ketchup has a lot of lycopenes and other anti-inflammatory factors. And it's cold because it comes from the refrigerator. So if you put that on right away along with your aspirin, you will decrease the inflammatory response. Now, that may not affect too much the DNA damage that you get. That's going to be done. But it will make it heal better and feel better as well.
Next, with the pool of primary care doctors shrinking, how some of the new ones are being inspired to return to the country to practice. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Access to healthcare services is crucial to ensure good health for all Americans. And access issues are even more acute in rural communities, which on the whole are experiencing severe medical professional shortages. Upstate Medical University has a program to address this need, and here to tell us more about it are Sally Hartwick and Rebecca Steinke, both second-year medical students at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
So you guys are second-year students now. You just finished your first year. Mm-hmm. How did it go, your first year? Was it a challenge?
It was hard, but well worth the effort. Yeah. I think I'm looking forward to learning even more in depth this upcoming year. A lot of the first year was review from previous years, just super condensed. And I'd like to learn the new stuff now and more type medicine type things. So,
well, you know, Rebecca, that's actually very interesting, because I'm sure that this new experience that you had also we want to talk about today is kind of a unique one. Tell us about this whole idea of a special training program called Rural Medical Scholars Program. Sally, tell us, what exactly is it?
So the RMed program...
RMed is short for Rural Med.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Rural Medical Education, also the Rural Medical Scholars Program. It's basically a program to try to funnel medical students and health professionals into areas that are underserved across New York State.
Specifically geographic areas we're talking about, not areas of study necessarily.
No, yeah, geographic areas that are isolated or small communities across the state who are in desperate need of physicians and other healthcare professionals.
So how does it work, Rebecca?
So you apply either you're going into first year or you can add on going into third year. You can join the program then. If you apply going into first year like Sally and I did, you are selected during the admissions process to have a separate interview with the RMed coordinator, Dr. Greenwald, or one of his co-workers in the department. And they'll basically select you then further to enter the Rural Medical Scholars Program. And your first 2 years, you do the RMed elective. So the first year, you interview the head of a rural hospital, and then you also interview the head of the public health in a rural county. And so those two interviews form the basis of a paper that you write.
To try to understand both the needs?
Yes. The needs and just where you fit into that picture as well, where you give you a good perspective. And then your second year, you actually start shadowing rural physicians, I believe, and write another paper. I'm not quite sure about the details. I'd have to look it up. But then third year is when you really begin the rural practice. You're assigned 3 out of your 8 rotations to a rural community. And you live there, you work there side by side.
Is it a community of your choice, or is it a place you are placed?
So it's where you're placed, but they work with you to pick your first choice. It's very give and take. It's not you're going here or this or that. They like to place people in as close to their hometown community as possible, actually.
So what is the hope by putting you into that environment? I read somewhere between 19 and 36 consecutive weeks as a med student, a third-year medical student, you would be working along with a family practitioner or some person in a rural community and basically be shadowing and learning in that environment. What's the hope, though?
Well, I think actually working in these communities provides more of a cultural sensitivity. You develop a relationship with not only the family doctors, but the people you're living with in this small town. You get to meet them. You get to know their lives. You also get a lot of one-on-one mentorship with these physicians who have so much to teach and are so willing to share and help you on your journey. Mm-hmm. So I think, it's beneficial on all sides.
It's a win-win.
Definitely. Yeah.
But it sounds to me also like there's obviously the underlying hope here is that in making those bonds or in having those positive experiences, you might then what, Rebecca?
Return back. And I think that's the idea of placing you in a location that's near your hometown. And it's to generate, again, that feeling of connection. This is my community. I care about these people. You live and work so closely and so personally. When you're working in a city medical center, it's really nice and you can see a lot of cool cases. But there is a little bit less of the personal connection aspect. And so they're hoping that you will return maybe to work someday in your site, maybe even as a resident.
Are you both from rural communities? How about you, Sally? Where are you from?
I'm from South New Berlin, New York.
And is that, what size community is that?
A few thousand people.
And where is that near?
Near Norwich, mm-hmm. another small town. It's actually one of our med sites, you know, near Hamilton, Oneonta, that kind of southern.
So is that what, and how about you, Rebecca?
I'm from Lima. It's a town of 2,000. And before that, I lived in Leicester, which is a town of 400. So definitely rural.
And was that part of what, I mean, obviously it sounds like that was what part of motivated you to
certainly
engage in this kind of a program? Because does it feel kind of connected or?
Definitely. And I think Upstate does a great job of recruiting students from smaller towns and smaller communities. And it's really one of their priorities is giving kids from these smaller areas an opportunity in an environment where they feel really comfortable to engage in what they're passionate about and not try to mold them into a big university hospital doctor or subspecialist.
And this program, I understand, just celebrated a 25th anniversary, so mm-hmm. a year ago or so. So it's really been very longstanding at this mm-hmm. point. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Sally Hartwick and Rebecca Steinke, both second-year medical students at Upstate Medical University. We're talking about Upstate's Rural Medicine Scholars Program. And you guys recently, though, did something a little bit more unique.
Yes.
You involved yourself, or this was the first year of a pilot within this program. Tell us about what that was, Sally.
So the Rural Immersion Week was really a joint effort by, I think, seven different organizations in Oswego and Cayuga County. And they came together with the goal of recruiting more physicians, more healthcare professionals to their area. So what they did was offer us a $500 stipend for 1 week. We got to live in the community. We got to tour the historic sites. We got to work with the firefighters, with paramedics. We got to work at the hospital, a small community hospital, and do multiple specialty rotations there. We got to work with multiple family practice clinics and just, you know, really engage with the community and get to know.
So this was, in a sense, almost a pilot or a kind of a attempt, I don't know how to say this exactly, but a first look at what the next third year full immersion or full
elective would be. That's what attracted it. It made it so attractive to me in general was looking ahead, I could see I wasn't going to have a chance really to live and work in a rural area until possibly my third year. And so I jumped on this right away. I said, oh, sweet. We get to live for a week, get to really know the area, everything up, you know, everything that's going on, and really connect with the people. And that's what happened during that week.
And gives you a chance to determine whether this is a direction you may actually want to pursue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also gives the opportunity for students at Upstate who aren't from rural areas to try it out for a week without the commitment.
It's like a snapshot.
Exactly. You know, it's really a window into the life of what it means to be a rural doctor.
So how does this RMed concept, how does it, Rebecca in particular, how does this connect to your experiences in the rest of your medical education?
It tied it all together. I feel I might be a little bit of a more dramatic case, but during first year, coming from a rural area and very clear goals of, you know, what I wanted to do, I wanted to work in underserved populations. I wanted to work in a rural area. My whole admissions essay to Upstate and to other medical schools. But really what drew me to Upstate was their rural program in general. But that whole essay was based on these desires to work in a rural underserved area. And I kind of lost sight of that throughout the first year just in the overwhelming amount of material, you know, the perspectives you're learning. It's very distracting, I would say.
I would say
but
it's daunting.
I think that's kind of what you get, though, in medical school. You can't expect anything else, and I was prepared for that, but I don't think I was prepared to have my own goals placed so far to the side and to kind of forget. I kind of forgot almost why I was in med school. I just kept learning and learning and learning, and that was great, and I had a lot of fun, and I learned a lot. And I felt like I was growing as a physician, but I wanted my direction back again. So going into this rural week, I felt like I found my compass in a sense, just connecting, especially, I want to say, with the physicians in the primary care clinics that we worked in, just because we had a little bit more time with them, the way things were arranged, just speaking with them, watching the way they interacted with their patients, seeing the dynamics, seeing their heart and how competent, but how encouraging they were. It was a beautiful balance. And I just remember coming home one night and speaking with Sally, and because we stayed at the same hotel, and we just talked for hours about it. And the thing that was so clear in my mind, the thought was, now I get it again. Now I know why I'm here.
That's wonderful.
It felt amazing to come back.
What did you learn, Sally? I mean, in that experience, in terms of some of the things Rebecca alluded to, what did you learn?
Yeah, well, I definitely share a lot of, I think, what Rebecca experienced as well this first year, coming from a small town, wanting to be a country doctor. Sometimes, even if you say that out loud in class, you'll get funny looks, or they'll say, you know, that doesn't exist. What are you talking about? You know? And so to really find that internal validation through this program, and to see how accomplished these physicians were, how engaging they were with their patients, it was really inspiring. I think it also reconnected us to a peer group within Upstate that does care about these issues and does care about rural underserved communities.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, another part of the Rural Immersion Week was speaking to high school students from these small communities, and I think through talking to them, you know, we were really able to feel like we were actually making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps inspiring.
Well, yeah,
some
but also
to consider a career in that direction.
Yeah, but also just giving them a window to say, you know, we came from small towns too, and you know,
you can make it.
You can do it.
That's very exciting. Tell me, what in particular can you point to an experience, or can you, either of you, in terms of your observing or participating with one of these rural doctors, was there anything that you can point to that was particularly memorable in terms of the interactions? You're talking about it being inspiring. You're talking mm-hmm. about learning a lot about their competence and their sensitivity. Do you have any little anecdote to share with us? Just a little bit of time we have.
I don't think there was one particular moment that would stand out incredibly, but I do remember the moment when the pieces started coming together in my mind, and it was, I was shadowing Dr. Snow in a clinic outside of Oswego, and I remember he saw a patient, and he just picked up on the little tiniest details with how they looked, and, you know, a little sign in the way their hands were, and he came out and he had a whole diagnosis that was very accurate from that, and he later confirmed it by asking them questions. But I just was amazed, because a lot of the physicians I've shadowed before are, you know, they have a lot of patient's disease, so they come in, they get it done, and they're very efficient and very good, but then they come out, and it just was encouraging to see that he noticed all those little tiny things.
It's kind of the art of physical diagnosis.
Yes.
Maybe is still alive in some parts
yeah.
of the country.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in. My guests have been Sally Hartwick and Rebecca Steinke. They're both second-year medical students, and they've recently participated in a rural medicine immersion program at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for coming in and telling us all about it. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Our society seems to celebrate youth while sometimes demeaning older age. But Central New York poet Mary Gardner has a different take. She uses the traditional yearly checkup to remind us, and perhaps our physicians and nurse practitioners, that they could ask more questions than those listed on the computer forms. Here is self-report. I know her time with me would be brief, kind, informed by testimony, mine and hers, a careful exam, labs and screens reviewed. For my age, I exceed the expected. I know the rules for living well, will heed advice and be affirmed 6 months from now. Outside the door, I pause, Could I return, report on signs, issues not conforming to boxed X's, or lines too short for words? Like theater seats, no longer suited for hearing, sight lines, merely getting there. Obsessing on hair, height, tone, collar lines, whether my next new car will be my last. Maintaining grace on dance floors, stairs, black ice, accepting a proffered arm with pleasure. Could healthy smoothies hide the tastes I crave? Will they still satisfy as comfort food for youthful fans when they are of an age? Should name recall delay be seen as loss or exponential gain, a greater trove, a lifetime spent accumulating them? Yes, I've learned to spin these agitations and dare to weave them into poetry, these unseen lines, end of the page, at X.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore that strange phenomenon of mass hysteria in children. Plus, how medical schools can play a more powerful role in maintaining our pool of primary care physicians, and how to prevent senseless auto injuries in our teenagers. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it by going to our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.